You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered.
Listener supported.
Community radio from South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community and supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Barbara Fuqua.
And I'm Scott Weddle. This is the Daily Local News for Wednesday, February 7, 2018.
Some of those bat species have a major role in plant pollination. They also, some of those eat fruit, and so they disseminate seeds across the landscape. You know, how many folks like tequila? Well, primary pollinator of those agave plants are bats.
Coming up later in the program, the Hoosier National Forest is opening its caves for the first time in years. As WFHB correspondent Jonah Chester reports, a fungal infection had wiped out millions of bats in the caves over the past couple of years. That story's coming up in today's WFHB feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, the dangers of using your cell phone while driving are fairly apparent, but insurance companies and safety experts are calculating the risk of using cell phones and what they're costing consumers. The story is coming up later in the program and on a new edition of our consumer watchdog segment, Better Beware. But first, your daily headlines.
Travelers on Bloomington Southwest Side near Country Club Drive should be prepared for lane closures over the next 6 months. This month, the county road project at Clear Creek is prompting Duke Energy to move power lines between South Rogers and South Walnut Streets. Country Club Drive will be periodically reduced to one lane between 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. Monday, February 12 through Friday, February 16. Engineering specialist Sarah Gomez says the one lane will be subject to additional intermittent closures on Thursday, the 15th.
It would be 10-minute intervals of closure and 45 minutes of the road being open, completely open for vehicles to pass through.
The Board of Public Works approved the road closures in its February 6 meeting. Duke Energy Project Manager Julie Pointer told the board the lane closures are a safety precaution while workers move the power lines.
On the 15th, we would need the total lane closure as they're pulling the spans across the road. That way we wouldn't have to worry about any big trucks coming through, snagging a line, pulling a guy out of a bucket, you know, causing any kind of accidents that could be avoided. So it would be the 10-minute closure as they're pulling those four spans across the road with the 45-minute kind of downtime in between just to get it prepped and ready.
Board member Kelly Boatman clarified what drivers will experience next Thursday.
The road on that day, on the 15th, is still going to have one lane blocked, one lane open, and then there'll be intermittent times where that one lane that was open is also going to be blocked.
Correct. So as they're pulling the span across the road, they'll need it closed for the 10 minutes.
Yeah, so when traffic can flow through, it's still going to have to flow through that one point in a single lane with a flagger.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
Okay.
Pointer says the project will not impact the pedestrian crosswalk at the Beeline Trailhead. Country Club Drive between Walnut and Rogers will close again March 5th through the 26th, while the City Utilities Department lays 12,000 feet of new sewer pipe. The installation is part of the larger citywide South Central Interceptor project. The Utilities Department has agreed to install a temporary pedestrian route if the project disrupts area sidewalks. A third closure will be in effect from March 26th through July 23rd. Monroe County Public Works Director Lisa Ridge says this time county workers will be removing the Clear Creek Bridge.
We're working together to do kind of good communications with the public. We know there's a lot of projects going to be there in the next 4 or 5 months, 6 months. So we want to get as much notice out to the public and detour routes and working with the city on that and CBU. So.
Board members asked for additional signage on Walnut and Rogers Streets, advising drivers to seek an alternate route.
12 area social agencies are in line to receive a total of $560,000 in Community Development Block Grant, CBDG money, this year. The federal grant funds social service and physical improvement projects. How much gets allocated and to whom is determined by a Citizens Advisory Committee. Dan Bixler with the city's Housing and Neighborhood Development Department presented recommendations for the social service allocations in Monday's Redevelopment Commission meeting.
Starting out, there's Community Kitchen. They, for their meals program, their daily meals that they provide, the committee, Social Service Committee, recommended $24,000. Next, Boys and Girls Club. Now, they have several units, but this is specifically for their program up in the Crestmont neighborhood for their Crestmont unit, and they were recommended for $22,000. Mother Hubbard's Cupboard for their pantry program and the education that they provide around food-related topics to folks for $20,000. Hoosier Hills Food Bank for their food bank program at $19,000. Monroe County United Ministries, they run several programs. This is specifically for their affordable child care program that they run now at two different campuses. And that was recommended at $10,000. And then finally, Middleway House for their emergency sheltering of victims of domestic violence, recommended at $10,000.
Bixler says the actual allocation amounts could vary, depending on how many CDBG grant dollars the city receives this year. Redevelopment Commission member Sue Scambellori serves on the Social Services Citizens Advisory Committee. Scambellori explained how the committee prioritizes requests to the new commission member, Edward Sandweiss.
Considerations that we had too, the priority always goes to emergency needs, first of all, so food, shelter. So very often if we have to make a tough choice, wait a minute, we always have to make a tough choice when we do these. We will look in the direction of emergency needs. Number two, we also talked with different agencies about whether or not partial funding would make a difference. And in some cases, it would. It would make a difference, and they were able to actually make some meaningful changes or improvements or whatever with partial funding. Some agencies weren't. Some needed the whole amount and said, you know, really, if we can't get this amount, we can't do what we hope to do. And let's just revisit this next year or Jack Hopkins. So does that help a little bit?
So those conversations can take place during the deliberation.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Six other agencies are in line to receive grant allocations for physical improvement and rehabilitation projects. HAND program manager Bob Wolford presented those allocation recommendations, which total $455,000. Wolford says these allocation amounts also depend on the size of the city's 2018 CDBG grant.
The City of Bloomington CDBG funds for physical improvement exceeds $455,000. Then the remaining funds will be dispersed equally between Life Design, Centerstone, and Boys and Girls Club, until those activities have been fully funded. If additional CDBG funds remain, then those funds will be equally split between the City of Bloomington's Planning and Transportation Department and City of Bloomington Utilities. The City of Bloomington's actual 2018 CDBG allocation for physical improvements is less than $455,000, then each funded activity will be reduced by the same percentage.
The Redevelopment Commission approved the recommended allocations. Members also approved allocating $50,000 of unused 2017 CDBG grant dollars to the city's home rehabilitation program. Commission member David Walter voiced his support.
Over the years I've been involved here, that's a very good program. It's always had support of the commission. Basically, people's homes deteriorate and they don't have the wherewithal to get things fixed. So a very well-run program. You've saved a lot of single-family homes for people that otherwise could not afford these repairs. So very supportive of this.
In other business, Controller Jeff Underwood says the city is taking initial steps to purchase the IU Health Bloomington Hospital site on 2nd Street.
We'll be doing appraisals on the property. We'll also have the Urban Land Institute coming in to work with the city on appropriate uses, future uses of the site, as well as the purchase from IU.
Walter asked Underwood whether the city can afford to buy the property.
Do we have the money?
Yes.
It's been a while since I've seen a TIF balance sheet on what's out there.
Yes, we're currently working with the mayor on a 10-year capital plan overall for the city, but this has been accounted for in that plan, and we do have sufficient funds to do this.
The Redevelopment Commission is scheduled to meet again on February 19th.
Kilroy's on Kirkwood's alcohol license is being challenged by Bloomington residents. At the Monroe County Alcohol Board's meeting this morning, around a half dozen citizens spoke out against the renewal of the bar's alcohol license by the county. City Council members Steve Boland and Isabel Piedmont Smith were among the residents in opposition to the renewal, as was City of Bloomington's Mayor's Office spokesperson Mary Catherine Carmichael. Monroe County Alcohol Board member and WFIU-WTIU manager Perry Metz says this morning's proceedings were unusual in what is generally an uncontested license renewal process.
The permit came up for consideration by the commission. Typically, when a permit holder has had no violations, that means the excise police have not found cases of minors being served, or they have not found cases of servers who had not undergone training or didn't have the appropriate server's permit. As long as there are no violations, that is what's considered an automatic renewal. So under normal circumstances, it would be on the agenda and all of the automatics would be voted on at the same time. The one thing that can change that is if members of the public show up to remonstrate against, to speak against one of the applicants or one of the permit holders. In this case, there were several people who came and indicated they wanted to speak. Well, because the permit holder thought it was going to be automatic, the owners were not present, and so they were allowed to continue until next month's meeting, knowing that there would be people speaking against it, and presumably they would want to attend and make their case.
The Monroe County Alcohol Board meets on the first Wednesday of every month. The question of Kilroy on Kirkwood's alcohol license renewal will be heard at the board's next meeting, March 7th. The Local Alcohol Board Handbook, issued by the state, sets three conditions for the renewal of an alcohol license by a local business owner. One, the applicant must be of good moral character. Two, the permit premises must not be a public nuisance. And three, criminal offenses must not have taken place at the premises. Met says the County Alcohol Board is currently looking to the state to guide the procedure for their next meeting. Kilroy's on Kirkwood's lawyer, who was present at the meeting, is asking for public comment to be limited to the people who showed up in this morning's meeting. Met says the board should hear back from the state in the next couple of weeks about whether that request should be implemented.
The position of the attorney representing Kilroy's was that these people who showed up today are the ones who responded to the public notice, took the time and trouble to attend, and they're the ones who should be able to speak, not additional people who may hear about it and feel, well, if there are some folks going, then I'll go too. The remonstrators felt that it's public comment and that the board should always be open to that, no matter how many people want to come additionally. That decision will not be made by the local board. It will be made by the state office of alcohol, tobacco.
The Kilroy's franchise was bought several years ago by a pair of out-of-state entrepreneurs and has generated outrage from the local community for a series of offensive tweets and publications, including encouraging billionaire Mark Cuban to check out underage women at Kilroy's Recess in Bloomington and for Kilroy's on Kirkwood customers to, quote-unquote, black out during a solar eclipse. Kilroy's has since apologized for the messages. The Kilroy's on Kirkwood property is owned by the Indiana University Foundation. Monroe County Alcohol Board meetings are open to members of the public. The next meeting is Wednesday, March 7th at 9 a.m.
Support for WFHB comes from Cardinal Spirits Distillery, located on the B-line. Cardinal Spirits has opened a new kitchen featuring local, seasonal food made from scratch to complement their craft cocktails. Dinner is available Tuesday through Saturday at Cardinal Spirits, 922 South Morton Street. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Barbara Fuqua.
And I'm Scott Weddle. Indiana's caves, largely focused around the southern karst topography of the state, are reopening. The Hoosier National Forest prohibited entrance into its caves for fear of spreading a deadly fungal infection that's ravaged bat populations. As WFHB correspondent Jonah Chester reports, the death of millions of bats has dire implications for other parts of the state's ecosystem.
The Hoosier National Forest is reopening its caves this summer for the first time in nearly a decade. The caves were closed indefinitely in 2009 to prevent the spread of a fungal infection known as white nose syndrome. The disease has caused the deaths of millions of bat species across the United States and has caused innumerable losses in the Hoosier National Forest.
Well, the white nose syndrome is a result from a fungus. It has a very strange name, Pseudogymnoscus destructens. This particular fungus thrives in the cold and humid environments where bats hibernate. It's kind of a bad deal in that sense because the ideal environmental factors for its growth is exactly the best ones for where the bats would occur in a cave. And the white nose syndrome, it was named that because some of the bats will develop a white fuzzy appearance around their nose, ears, and on their wings, but it's not always visible.
That was wildlife biologist Richard Winstead. Winstead is the supervisory biologist for the Hoosier National Forest, meaning he has oversight of the Fish and Wildlife Program for the whole forest. He's been working in the Hoosier National Forest for years now and has dealt firsthand with white nose syndrome over the past decade. In addition to manifesting itself as a white fungus, the disease can also cause symptoms in bats that can hinder their ability to hibernate safely throughout the winter.
The other thing that happens to the bats is that they'll lose their fat reserves. Now picture this, the bats will eat insects through the summertime. They'll build up a layer of fat. That's what they subsist on through that entire winter period. Well, if you lose that prematurely, you're not going to survive through the winter. The bats that are affected, they tend to move around more. They break their dormancy. They're not, you know, think of it sort of as sleeping. They'll wake up every so often, but they'll do that more often, and they'll move around, they'll shuffle around in there. So every time they do that, they burn energy. Some researchers have shown that basically these infected bats will use energy about twice the level as a healthy bat would.
The disease can also cause erratic and sometimes fatal behavior.
Some of the other sort of symptoms of that is that bats will often behave strangely. And what I mean by that is that they'll move to the near the entrances of the cave, closer than they normally would be. The temperatures are colder there. Sometimes they'll even fly outside, you know, when it's freezing temperatures outside. Well, there's nothing, no real reason for them to do that. There aren't any insects or anything like that, but they'll go outside. And quite often that will result in the death of the bat. So some caves, what they would find is basically a bunch of dead bats laying on the ground outside of the cave.
Caves are relatively devoid of base-level nutrient sources, according to Winstead. Since there's no sunlight, there aren't a lot of flora that can survive the harsh conditions of the cave. This means that it's up to the bats, who leave the caves to eat, to provide the base level of the food pyramid in this ecosystem.
In Indiana, bats use caves, well, they do in other states as well, but they're primarily their winter season occupants. And when I say winter season, it's going to be late fall into about April there or thereabouts. Because the bats are outside through part of the year, they're eating insects and all that stuff, then they come in to occupy the caves. They're really bringing resources from the outside inside to the cave. Quite often, nutrients within a cave system itself can be in fairly low supply. It needs to come from someplace. So that's really the value of the bats being in there, is the bat guano, which is their manure, is really a basis for a food pyramid that's within this cave. So certain animals will digest that, and then those animals in turn will move out and distribute things out through the cave and so forth.
Without an adequate bat population, the entire cave ecosystem is impacted. While they aren't the only producer of those necessary base-level nutrients, bats play a substantial role in supporting other cave-dwelling organisms. The mass die-off of bats can be bad for more than just the cave's ecosystem, however. It can also cause issues in areas where they help fertilize crops and spread seeds.
When you get out, say, to the southwest of the United States, some of those bat species have a major role in plant pollination. They also, some of those eat fruit, and so they disseminate seeds across the landscape. You know, how many folks like tequila? Well, primary pollinator of those agave plants are bats.
The reason officials decided to initially close the Hoosier National Forest was to prevent the spread of the white nose-causing fungus from cave to cave. The fungus has the ability to attach itself to almost any kind of fabric or material and then remain there until someone enters another cave, at which point it can be spread to that cave's ecosystem by simply brushing up against a cave wall.
The other thing is the fungi tend to go into a spore that's kind of it's encased in a little protective coating, if you will. And that's how it survives in environments where, you know, all of a sudden become unfavorable. So those types of things have been detected on people's boots, their clothes, the webbing in their backpack or what have you. So now this thing has some environmental protection, if you will, and so it can be moved around. And if it's exposed to the right conditions again, then now it becomes an active fungus elsewhere.
Even though the caves are open again, it's important to still keep in mind prevention techniques to help prevent this disease from spreading to any additional caves. As Winstead points out, there still could be caves and cave systems in the Hoosier National Forest that are as of yet unaffected by white nose syndrome.
And so I guess my biggest recommendation is that folks that visit caves practice decontamination of their clothing and their gear. Because what you really want to avoid is that, you know, we have really no idea if it's in every cave or not. We can assume one way or the other, but let's reduce the odds that we're going to take it to one where it doesn't occur. And so that's the most proactive thing that we can do.
Across the United States, approximately 6 million bats have died because of this disease since 2007. The fatality rates in affected caves and wilderness areas is usually around 90 to 100%, according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. As for Indiana, there are no official numbers as of right now. Calculating the amount of affected bats is not an exact science, according to Winstead.
Well, we're not entirely sure, but what I can say is that based on hibernacula counts, so that would be bats that are hibernating in caves in the wintertime, we're seeing reductions on the Hoosier. The numbers kind of fluctuate each time they're counted somewhat, but we just see a general trend. We don't really have a percentage-wise. We also occasionally will try to capture bats in the summer. Here over the last couple of years, it's been very difficult for us to actually catch anything. So that just tells us that there's less available out there. We also use acoustic methods to sample bat populations, and that involves driving routes with detectors that will hear the bats, and there seems to be a decrease in the number of detections as well. So everything is pointing towards fewer bats being available in the landscape.
The Hoosier National Forest plans on reopening its caves on May 1st of this year. Those who enter the caves earlier risk disturbing the bats' hibernation and can face a fine of $5,000 and up to 5 months in jail. Reporting for WFHB, I'm Jonah Chester.
The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4100. 4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
Up next, our weekly consumer watchdog segment, Better Beware.
Welcome to Better Beware. Here's your consumer watchdog from WFHB Community Radio with the latest information and helpful hints designed to keep your head out of the clouds, your feet on the ground, and your money in your pocket.
I've got a friend who says he is digitally challenged because he has no cell phone and no computer and never goes online at all. Recently, I printed out some pictures and mailed them to him. It was so 20th century. But, you know, maybe he's got a point. Being connected these days is more hazardous than ever. Using a cell phone while you're driving, for instance, is dangerous, and it's restricted or just flat illegal in most every state, but lots of people still do it. I got behind a woman just the other day, chattering away, weaving in the lane, and putting on her brakes when she didn't need to. I stayed way behind her. But did you know that using your cell phone while driving may soon make your insurance rates go up? Allstate Insurance has announced they have technology that can tell when a phone is being used from a moving car. And they think it's a better way to calculate rates than just looking at your credit score. They say distracted drivers cost insurance agencies as much as 160% more than others. Using a cell phone while driving has always been stupid. Now it's going to be expensive, too. Then there's those things that are awkwardly called voice-controlled assistants. You know, Apple has Siri, Amazon has Alexa, Microsoft's is Cortana, and so on. They can be set up to control all kinds of things throughout your so-called smart home, if you think it's smart to have one. These things are always listening, and not just to you. There have been recent reports of systems reacting to voices coming out of a radio or TV. And now, a couple of security researchers, Nicholas Carlini and David Wagner, have found that these systems can be activated by an audio clip with a secret command, one you can't hear, embedded in it. In theory, someone could direct your computer to an evil website, or deactivate your home security system, or, well, you get the idea. Personally, I'm waiting until I can say, "Alexa, get me a beer." Sometimes it's hard to remember how brand new this whole digital thing really is. Steam engines took over a century to fully develop. Trains, cars, airplanes, telephones, radio, television, all took decades to become reliable and safe. Digital connectivity has only been around for an eye blink in historical terms, and at this stage, you've got to keep up with new dangers and new safeguards all the time. Keep your software updated. Do not link your online accounts together. Use separate, strong passwords for everything and two-factor ID when you can. It's great to send an old friend a picture with a swipe and a tap, but when you consider all those security precautions, maybe sticking a couple of printouts in an envelope is easier. It's certainly safer, at any rate. I'm Richard Fish for WFHB News and Public Affairs.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Wes Martin, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, in partnership with Community Access Television Services. Better Beware was produced by Richard Fish. Our feature was produced by Jonah Chester.
Our engineer today, Dan Withard. Our theme music provided by Ben Lumsdaine, Scott Schmatke, and Danny Graff. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, this is Scott Weddle.
And I'm Barbara Fuqua. Stay tuned for the Shortwave Report with Dan Roberts, a weekly look at headlines from around the world. That's coming up next on WFHB.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB Bloomington Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@wfhb.org. You can become a Daily Local News volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. You can find an archive of past shows and individual news reports online at wfhb.org and catch live broadcast of the Daily Local News Monday through Thursday at 5 p.m. We are local, longer.